Skipping lunch, I do it myself, it seems to be very, very good. Skipping breakfast does not seem to be good at all, right? So there's study after study after study showing decreased lifespan for people that skip breakfast.
Well, Dr. Longo, I'm in deep shit then if that's the case, because I don't think I've eaten breakfast in 25 years.
The Gary V audio experience.
Vayner Nation, it is great to be back on the Gary V audio experience. As we said earlier in the year, a lot less interviews, but ones that are more meaningful to me around subject matters that I'm interested in, people I'm interested in, events that I'm interested in, and today will be no different. Dr. Longo is with us. I'm gonna allow Valter to introduce himself in full detail. And we're gonna talk about something that I've been doing my whole life, long before it became something that I think is on many more people's radars, and we're gonna poke and prod around the history of it, the current of it, entrepreneurship, and many other things that I want to get to in this episode. But let's get into the intro part. Dr. Longo, how are you, my friend?
Good, how are you?
I'm well. Why don't you take the floor for 2-4 minutes and tell everybody who you are, full pledge, give us some context.
Okay. Well, I'm a biochemist by training, trained at UCLA, also a neurobiologist by training. And I'm now a professor of biogerontology, so studying aging, basically. And I'm also the director of the Longevity Institute at USC. And then I run a program on cancer and molecular oncology in Milan, Italy. And that's where we do all the most of the cancer work that we're carrying out. And my interest has always been, since I was 19 years old, aging. I used to be a musician, then I was enthusiastic about aging and excited about this world. And I was just surprised back then that everybody was not interested in this. And I have to say, in the last 30 years, everything changed. Back then, aging was viewed as a crazy science, and you know, we were asked at UCLA, why would you work on aging? And now everything has changed. But so that's all I've been doing since then. The biochemistry, then genetics of aging, was involved in the discovery of some of the key genes in the regulating lifespan, including the TOR-SCIS kinase pathway in aging regulation. And then eventually I was a student of Roy Walford. Roy back then was the guru of longevity and nutrition. Was a famous pathologist at UCLA that was my mentor for a number of years. And since then, we've been working on nutrition in parallel with the genetics of aging, working on nutrition and aging. And then eventually defined this fasting mimicking diet as a way to keep all the benefit of what Roy Walford was working on, which was called calorie restriction. So what happens in people if you just severely restrict calories all the time? So I didn't like that. And so eventually we switched from that, you know, a continuous restriction of calories, which works, it's fantastic in some sense, but bad in other senses, to a periodic fasting mimicking diet. Is it possible that you can do something only 3-4 times a year for 5 days, and you get all these effects, positive effects of calorie restriction, but not the negative ones, right?
So, Dr. Longo, why at such a young age did you fall in love or get passionate about aging? Why did that happen?
I don't know, but you know, I was a music major, and I just kept thinking about aging for some reason. I speculate.
Were you scared to die? Was it vain oriented? Like you didn't want to look older? Was it vanity, or was it fear, or something altogether different?
No, I mean, not older. I mean, of course, I was 19 years old. So I think it might have been, you know, when my grandfather died, I was 5 years old, and I was actually in the room when he died, you know. So I just think that connection, you know, when you're five, being in a room and just having this sense.
He died of a heart attack?
No, he died of a cancer that he wasn't treating, you know, and he was fairly young, 75, 76 or something like that. So I just thought I wasn't affected by it. At least I didn't think I was affected by it back then, right? I was very cool, and I looked almost like I was in charge of the situation as a five-year-old. Yes. But then I think that just stayed in my head, you know, life is not permanent, and so maybe I should work on that, right, rather than anything else that I can think of, you know.
I understand. So something very interesting with me is I grew up, I was born in the former Soviet Union. I came to America when I was 3. And, you know, my parents worked hard. My mom worked all day, you know, raising family. My dad worked all the time. And specifically my dad, he wouldn't eat breakfast or lunch. And he would always eat a lot of calories at dinner, you know. And that's how I got kind of brought up. And that's the track I had. And then somewhere along the line, in my mid-20s, you know, I started to gain weight for the first time in my life. And in my late 20s, I was gaining enough weight that I was like, wait a minute, this sucks. But I had no interest in working out or eating properly. And so what ended up happening was it was so easy for me to go from waking up until 7 or 8 p.m. without eating. My body, like, it's 1:38 p.m. right now. I haven't eaten breakfast or lunch, and that is my natural state. And I, you know, my friends are all so obsessed with lunch, and I always, you know, they always, when people meet me and get to spend time close to me, they're always fascinated by the no lunch thing. And but it's always been my whole life. I worked in the store and there was no time for lunch. That was when we'd get a rush in the store. And so when I was in my late 20s and I wanted to lose weight, it was easy for me to just fight at night. I used to always joke with my mom, it's like, I can do Yom Kippur once a week. You know, like, I could fast. You know, it wasn't easy because you're so hungry by night when your body's structured the way I was doing it. But then later in my late 30s and early 40s, the last, you know, 7-8 years, I really got serious about health and wellness. I work out all the time. I work on stretching, a lot of different things. And one of the go-tos for me when I'm struggling a little bit with food management has been fasting, and I really enjoy it, like very much enjoy it. Sure. What is it for most people? Because I've been talking to a lot of people about it, because it's obviously become, this is something you've been doing for your whole career in some shape or form. Obviously, as you know, you're with Prolong, you're very in it. Fasting has become much more top of mind for a lot of people over the last half decade.
Yeah.
What is it in people's minds when they first, so I've been talking a lot more about it, this is why I wanted you on the show. What is it that scares people so much? Like, it's unbelievable to me how many times I'm saying to my friends, you know, my friend will be like, man, I want to start getting my act together. Like, have you thought about fasting? That seems to them as, no way, I can't do that. I can't not eat in a day. Why is that such a, like, visceral reaction from so many people that I've come across?
Yeah, well, essentially, food is like drugs, right? So there's a clear addiction for good reason, not for bad reason, for good reason.
Right.
Well, we should eat, I mean, for the great majority of the history of humans, but also the primates and everything else before that, food, you eat as much as you can get, right? And because eventually the winter is going to come and you're not going to have anything. And so if you didn't overeat during the summer when there was a lot of fruits and honey and nuts, you're going to die, right? That's how strong that signal is. Eat, eat, eat. And get fat, by the way, right? And that was what saved you, right? Getting fat, as fat as possible, was what saved people during the winter. Yeah, so that's why you can't sort of instinct-wise, you cannot tell somebody stop eating. And then again, you know, it's very important in your show to point out that fasting, I always say, doesn't mean anything, right? So fasting is like eating. You know, is eating good for you? Well, yeah, some of it is, and some quantities, and some other foods are not, and some other quantities are not, right? So, for example, skipping breakfast, skipping lunch, I do it myself, it seems to be very, very good. Skipping breakfast does not seem to be good at all, right? So there's study after study after study showing decreased lifespan for people that skip breakfast, right? So then you could say,
Well, Dr. Longo, I'm in deep shit then, if that's the case, because I don't think I've eaten breakfast in 25 years. I better get my act together.
Yeah, it may be that on you, it does add a
factor. Of course.
Maybe you come from a family that always did it.
Of course. But I think that's it. You know, real quick, I apologize. It's an important point. As people have become obsessed with health and wellness, I keep reminding all the people in my life, I'm like, yes, that is a study. Yes, that is a trend. Yes, that is science. But don't forget, you better do individual work on your own blood work, on your own, like, you have to get a sense of you, just like anything. There are common themes, but some people have different structures, correct?
Yeah, correct. But you're still going to Vegas, right? So you're still betting against the numbers, right? So
correct,
the case
correct.
Of skipping breakfast, for example, you know, you're looking at about 10 studies pretty consistently showing reduced lifespan in those that skip breakfast. Now, is it breakfast? Is it that people that skip breakfast have bad behaviors in general and they're malnourished, et cetera, et cetera? Uh-huh. It's hard to know. What's surprising, right, though, is if it's so good to skip breakfast, why doesn't that counterbalance the bad behavior, right? Why don't we see at least neutral effects, right? You skip breakfast, it's very good for you. Why isn't it making your bad behavior neutral? And that's what's concerning, right? That we don't see a neutral effect. We see a negative effect. So that suggests, for example, could it be that the ketone bodies, we're doing mouse studies right now. And we were surprised to see that the highest ketone bodies of all were in the Western diet, right? So the Western diet also causes ketogenesis, you know, these byproducts of fat that people always talk about as a positive thing, but they're very high in the Western diet, right? So could it be that by having ketone bodies high all the time, you put a strain on your heart, or, you know, there may be fat accumulation, et cetera, et cetera? We don't know. So probably best to have breakfast and skip lunch. I think lunch is what I've been doing for 20 years. And it's a great way to regulate, you know, not get the ketone bodies too high, but control the weight. And I think it's got a central role in helping against diseases.
Dr. Logan, one of the reasons I really wanted you also is I've been thinking a lot about science, professors, professionals entering the entrepreneurial world. So there's a lot of people who are listening to my show who are in academia, who are in the medical field, who are in incredibly high virtue careers, who I think are worried at times to jump into entrepreneurship because they're taking their talents, their knowledge, this, you know, thing they put on a pedestal, and they're bringing it to the business world, and I'm very empathetic to them. They believe they are compromising, you know, selling out. They're worried about the judgment of their fellow, you know, partners in academia or finance or education or other things. You obviously have a company. You know, you do these things from a scientific, academic background. Was that a challenge for you to make the leap into entrepreneurship? Did you consider it? Was it something on your radar earlier in your life and you didn't want to do it because you felt like it could hurt the science, hurt the mission? It's not the right thing to do when you're trying to really help people. I think this is a profound conversation. And since you're going through it with Prolong, I thought you could be a great source of inspiration for some of the people that are on the fence. How did you go through your journey of being in this from a medical academic standpoint to making a jump into entrepreneurship?
You know, I think the other way around, right? So I will argue that I felt that if I wasn't going to do it, it wasn't going to happen. And that's probably true, right? So we were working on cancer and fasting mimicking diet and diabetes and fasting mimicking diet. And I just thought, for the sake of getting it out there to patients, if I don't go find the clinicians, if I don't sit down with them and start the trials, but also say, hey, it's a product, because otherwise, what are you going to do the clinical trial with, right? It was nearly impossible, I think, without a company, at least back then, 15 years ago, to start this operation. Now we have over 30 clinical trials running. And I think, you know, the company sponsors some of them, and lots of others are sponsored by the US government, by foundations, by the universities themselves, right? So I just felt kind of like this argument was also made about doctors, right? They should a doctor or a group of doctors right. own a hospital. And it turns out that's probably who you want to own a hospital, right? You want doctors to own the hospital because they're going to be much more aligned with the patient. When it comes down to a decision, a doctor is always going to go with protect the patient, right? A businessman yes. might not, right? Somebody selling drugs yes. might not, right? So in yes. my case, I'm always going to think there is no way I'm compromising you know, the safety and the health of the patient, even if it's $1 billion to be made, right? But I think a businessman would not hesitate. And I mean, you know, within the domains of the law or the limits of the law, I think most businessmen will say, well, if it's legal, I'll do it. I would say, no, it could be legal. It's going to hurt the patient. You're not going to do this. You
know? Of course. Of course. Yeah, I actually, you know, it's funny. I actually think the best businessmen and women think about the value exchange the most. I even think if it's going to hurt somebody emotionally, it's a bad thing. So, you know, I think that's a very powerful thing. What are the biggest misconceptions in the modern fasting conversation? Because you know what happens now? Bad business people who genuinely just care about money and could give a fuck about humans or patients, they see a trend and then they start exploiting it. What bad information, or like, help us here. Like, what's some of the stuff that undereducated influencers or entrepreneurs or even pseudo doc, like, what are we seeing from like bad information? Like, what's a thing that you see people believing is true but isn't? Give us a little cheat sheet of things to watch out for if you're on your journey to potentially get a little bit into fasting. Because for everyone who's listening, like, again, I know a lot of people genuinely are looking to be healthier and happier and all those things that you know, there's that famous clip in my content of like, what do I think about health and wellness when it comes to business? And I reply to the kid as I'm walking on the floor of a convention, I reply, well, if you're dead, you're out of business. And it like really got very popular. So, you know, I like having people like Dr. Longo on occasionally. One, because I thought that little part about entrepreneurship in the scheme of academia and health and is important. But then number two, you know, I like to keep everybody who's listening to the show around longer so they can achieve all their hopes and dreams. And I really think for a lot of you who've never tried it, that it is going to be fasting. That's going to be the breakthrough on you shedding 15 pounds, feeling healthier, feeling better, da 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 da. So I really want to inspire some people to at least try. It might not be right for you, but at least try. Dr. Longo, what are some of the, watch out for this right now because everyone's talking about it fasting?
One of them we already mentioned, right? For example, and probably the most popular of all, you can do 16 hours. And, you know, and I love the work that Sachin Panda and others have done on that. But the 16 hours of fasting and the skipping breakfast is clearly associated with lots of problems. You know, not just reduce life, but also gallstone formation. And so I would say that we need to go from the word fasting to what do we know that works, and there are many studies showing that it works and it's unlikely to cause any problems. And also, what is going to be the effect of this on lifespan and health span, and not just what's going to happen in the next 3 months? Are you going to lose some weight? So you could lose a lot of weight in a lot of ways, right? But you, most cases, you regain it back. And as you go through, let's say, 10% or more weight loss and 10% or more weight regain, that also is associated with a shorter lifespan, right? So it's better to do nothing than to do these yo-yo interventions. So I think the misconception is very wide. And so there are very few things that I think consistently work. For example, and don't have any negative studies associated with it. For example, 12 hours a day of fasting. I always say I've never seen a negative study on 12 hours of fasting, 12 hours of feeding. So it's time-restricted eating. Is not, you don't get the benefit, the quick benefits that you get with 14 or 16 hours, but you may get long-term. I mean, much easier to stay with it, and then, you know, much more likely to get you to a long lifespan. And then, you know, of course, the other one I'm a fan of is, you know, fasting mimicking diet, let's say 3 or 4 times a year. Again, a safety record is very, very good. I think over probably 1 million people now have done it, and we haven't heard back from, I mean, the side effects have been really spectacularly low. And yeah, so I think that, and I think the fasting mimicking diet underlines the importance of having things clinically tested. So we have the FDA for drugs, right? So we have this incredible process. Even look at what happened with COVID, right? I mean, we still have, people were dying, but everybody said, wait, you know, we cannot get things out there just because they may save lives, because they're probably going to hurt more people than they save. So let's wait until the approval. It went very quickly, but it still required approval. Now in the fasting world and all of that, there is no approval at all. It's just you wake up in the morning, you hear something, and it's like, okay, I'm going to start doing it. Well, that's probably going to hurt you in the long run. Not help you, but hurt you. So focus on the things that have lots of clinical trials on. And so, yeah, 12 hours of fasting and the fasting mimicking diet 3 or 4 times a year. I think those are very good. And then, you know, I wrote a book called The Longevity Diet, and all of it. By the way, all my shares of the company are going to go to charity, right? So that's another way of, and I don't take a penny in consulting from the company. So I really financially don't make it from the company.
We're talking about Prolon.
We're talking about Prolon and La Nutra. Yeah. So that.
One more time, because I think it's going to be a pretty big business.
Already is a pretty big business. From what I'm seeing from afar.
Mazel tov! Congratulations. So you're saying all of the profits that are coming your way, you're donating.
100% of my shares and 100% of the consulting
or
whatever goes already to my foundation, the Create Cures. Foundation and even my book royalties go to my foundation, right? So I really only make whatever I make at the university as a professor and nothing else, right? So
was that important to you because you felt that it wouldn't compromise your professor medical work?
Yes, because I got attacked by lots of journalists, right? And I got attacked on this years ago already, and I could sense that that fair or not, they were going to attack me. Oh, he's trying to exploit the research to make money. And so I say, you know what, I'm just gonna do this.
Dr. Long, like before we get out of here, like, what's your intuition? Like, if everything goes well, this may happen after you're not on Earth. Like, what's your intuition as humans become more educated with the power of what I would call food scheduling, right? Like just being more educated on how this all works. What do you think it kind of looks like 50, 100 years from now if this is universally understood and executed?
Yeah, I think it's going to, I like to think it's what's going to happen in the next 10 years. I think what's going to happen, you're going to have two groups in the world, right? You're going to have whatever, 8 billion people that don't listen to anything. They do whatever they want. And then you're going to have maybe 500 million to 1 billion people that say, you know what, I'm going to follow the scientists, the science, you know, what I call the multi-pillar approach, you know, clinical studies, epidemiological studies. You put it together and you get a pretty clear picture. In fact, there was a study that came out a couple of weeks ago on PLOS Medicine showing if you start, even at age 60, if you start something very close to what I described as the longevity diet, you are associated, your life is going to have 8 or 9 extra years, right? So starting right now. So I think that, we're going to have this two population, one following everything and living maybe an extra 20 years. And everybody else improvising and maybe on average living 20 years less. Eventually, I think, you know, we're going to get better and better, you know, 100 years from now, then I think it's a different world. You know, it's a different world. And I think, unfortunately or fortunately, we're going to see a lot of engineering, bioengineering, robotics, playing a part, you know. So now we can make artificial hearts, artificial, you know, pancreas, releasing insulin, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that, and it should be so. It's going to be much more a part of human life, you know, going to be part human and part machine. And you know, we already are, right? So we already are, and lots of people are walking around with pumps, diabetes type 1. So it's just a reality, and the engineers are so good that moving forward, it's going to take a long time, right? So I think now nutrition is by far the investment for the next 20 or 30 years. Eventually, slowly, I think that the technology is going to take over. And
Dr. Longo, if I asked you, if somebody's 20 years old right now, what's your guess, your educated guess on what their life expectancy is?
So the study showed that if you started the longevity diet or something like it at 20, that would be 13 extra years of life expectancy, right? So then you're looking at a 20-year-old following everything, maybe looking at 105 as an average lifespan, which is pretty remarkable, right? So 105 average following all the right things. with lots of people making it 110, 115. So that's what I think it's, the numbers are showing, but it's gotta be a careful, consideration of all the things you do, probably working with some professionals that help you get there.
Anything we didn't touch on as we get out of here?
Just very briefly, the longevity diet. I think, you know, please, what came out of that study was lots of legumes, no red meat, no processed meat, lots of nuts, lots of vegetables. And so those are the main things that came out of the everyday nutrition. And fish was allowed, but that seemed to be the best animal source of proteins. So some fish and everything else coming from legumes, protein-wise. So a diet that almost nobody in the United States follows, but that it will make a tremendous difference, I think, together with the FMDs on making people live longer and healthier.
But so many people don't want to give up steak.
You know, it's, but we published a study a few months ago where we took mice and we put them on a high-calorie, high-protein, really bad Western diet, right? And they became very big, you know, and they live very short.
Yes.
And then we did exactly the same, but we gave them once a month the fasting mimicking diet, and it reversed everything. So they live normal life, perfect weight. So then I think if you don't want to give up anything, if somebody's going to have a bad Western diet, then it might have to be as frequently as once a month the fasting mimicking diet.
So wait a minute, real quick. That's a really interesting insight. It is your hypothesis that if you're a bad Western dieting, that if you fast for on a certain regimen once a month, that there's an offset there that is balancing.
Well, we've shown
bit?
This in now three clinical trials, right? And there's a fourth one. I mean, one we published, three are going to be published in the next 6 months, right? So very clearly, the people that start the worst, you know, the ones that have higher cholesterol, higher blood pressure, higher fasting glucose, they're the ones that do the best after the three cycles of the fasting mimicking diet. So very clearly mice, but also very clear in human trials that yes, those that have the worst diet could potentially, and we're not at all saying, okay, keep a bad diet. In fact, I just said, you know, people should switch to a longevity diet, but understanding that most people don't want to do that, or lots of people don't want to do that, then yes, you might have to go to a fasting mimicking diet as often as once a month. But then I think as that helps you, then you could go once every 2 months, once every 3 months. So it could be that at the beginning, you have a bad diet and then you do the FMD once a month. And then eventually maybe once every 2 or 3 months could be enough to offset at least lots of problems caused by your bad habits, not just diet, you know, smoking, you know, we haven't tested that, but I mean, that's what we speculate, at least, you know, that it could be a way to reverse bad habits, you know.
Cheers. Dr. Longo, thank you for being on the show.